replied. "How about getting it out to our place?" Mal asked. Baker's head rocked side to side. "That will take a little longer. But you can do it, can't you?"
"Babe," I said, "don't get your hopes up for power to the house."
"We'll get it out there. It's just going to take a while. We'll have to clear all the lines out there. But we've got a system now," Baker replied.
I nodded up the road.
"So this will power the armory, the clinic, and the county building?" Baker wiped her forehead with the back of a gloved hand.
"Yeah. We're going to bring up the armory first, then the clinic, then the courthouse. The guys are up there testing the transformers now."
It was a major step. Real progress everyone could see. And I hoped it would be a boost for the entire community. Not that it would affect their daily lives, but just seeing that it's coming, that things are returning to normal, would reinforce people's will. Maybe pick their spirits up after recent events. The Striker was sitting in the park, not far from the burned-out hull of the 5-ton truck. The bodies were all gone, though the park still smelled of death. The acrid stench of the fire, the putrid smell of the dried blood and other organic matter, mixed into innocuous funk. Sarge and the guys were standing on the ground in front of the gallows with the prisoners. I hopped out of the bed of the truck and told Mel I was going to look for Mitch. She gripped my hand and said she was coming with me. We made our way through the crowd until I found Mitch and Michelle by the side of the gallows. He was watching the goings-on and asked,
"What's this all about?"
"We're about to hold court," I replied.
"What do you mean?"
I nodded at the three bound men. "They're the ones that attacked the park. We caught them in the act. The one in civilian clothes there, he's caused a lot of problems here. He's going to read an accounting of his crimes, and you'll decide his fate."
"Here? Like this?"
I nodded. "Look at these people. They think the army, that we, attacked the park. That we're the ones responsible for all this."
"I've heard people saying that," Michelle said. "There's lots of talk about it."
"Well, it wasn't us, of course, but we need the people here to know that, so we're going to do this in public, in front of everyone. Otherwise, things are going to get out of control."
"And they're close to that point now,"
Cecil said from behind me.
I turned to look at him, and he continued, "People are really upset. There was a lot of folks killed, little kids even, and they want vengeance. And they're about ready to take it into their own hands."
"And we can't allow that," I replied.
"But is this the right way?" Mitch asked. "Is this the way to do it? Is he really responsible?"
I nodded. "Yes, he is. He was spotting for a mortar team, him and another guy. The other one is dead, but we have his body here to show everyone. There were a couple other soldiers in the mortar group, but they were killed in the fight."
"I think it's the right thing," Michelle said. "By doing it this way, no one can say it wasn't proper. Everyone will see the same thing. There can be no confusion."
Mitch thought about it for a minute.
"I guess you're right. It's being done out in the open." He nodded. "It's for the best."
I clapped him on the back and we walked around to the front of the gallows. The crowd was full of whispers and murmurs. There was the occasional finger pointed in our direction, accompanied by hushed words. The crowd was obviously on edge, and it wasn't certain where they stood on things at the moment. But we were about to find out. I leaned in to Dalton and said, "Let's take them up the platform."
"Why are we going up there?"
Micah asked.
"So everyone can hear what you have to say," I replied. "And to make sure they can't get to you."
He obviously hadn't considered the possibility of the crowd wanting to tear him apart. He quickly turned and headed for the steps. Dalton followed him up, with Mike and Ted bringing the two Cubans up. The crowd began to hush as I stepped up to the edge of the platform. I looked out across the crowd, then down at Sarge. He was standing at the bottom of the steps, preventing anyone from rushing up the steps. I looked back over my shoulder at Mitch, and he nodded. I nodded back and cleared my throat.
I know there are a lot of rumors going around about what happened here.
Heads bobbed and words were exchanged throughout the crowd. But we're here to set the record straight on what happened.
How are we supposed to believe you?
Someone shouted from the crowd. Because I'm not the one that's going to tell you what happened. Surprise swept over those gathered. The men responsible for that horrible event will tell you themselves what they did. I nudged Micah with an elbow. He hesitated, and I pushed him towards the edge of the platform. Leaning in close, I whispered, "Start talking, or I'll throw you off here and tell them what you did myself." Fear covered his face as he looked out across the park, but he started to speak softly.
"My name is Micah," he began weakly.
"We know who you are,"
someone shouted from the front of the crowd.
"Speak up, we can't hear you,"
another voice shouted.
"Tell us what you did,"
yet another shouted.
"I was with these men and others who bombed the park the other day,"
Micah managed to say. The crowd erupted with shouts of "Why?" "Terrorist?" and others. Micah shrank from the shouts. Then a rock flew out of the crowd and hit him in the chest. He turned to shield himself as other things started to fly from the crowd. Sticks, pieces of concrete, blackened pieces of metal from the truck. The end of a mortar round, with the stabilizing fin still attached. I drew my pistol and fired two rounds into the air.
"That's enough of that shit,"
I shouted, as the crowd pressed away from us. I leaned over to Ted and asked for the piece of paper with the notes. He handed it to me, and I stepped to the edge of the platform.
"As many of you know, the DHS ran a camp out in the forest before we kicked them out. Many atrocities were committed there. The DHS members were being sent to a prison after being captured by the army. Micah here helped them escape. He's also the one that sprayed herbicide on our farm in an attempt to deny you food. He also worked with others to plant the bomb at the park earlier this year. He consorted with the Russian and Cuban forces that currently are causing trouble, which leads us to what happened here. Micah and another man acted as spotters for the mortar team that launched the attack on the park where so many were killed and injured. Which brings up another point. Some of you are starting rumors that the army committed this crime against us. And I say us because that's what I mean. We were here when the attack started. We lost people, both killed and wounded as well. I looked down at Danny, standing in front of the platform. We were here handing out food for crying out loud. How could you think we were the ones to do something like this? I paused for a moment as the crowd shared some guilty glances. That sort of thinking is exactly what the enemies committing this violence want you to do. They want to splinter us, to separate us, cause division. But we have to stick together. I stopped, trying to think of what to say next when someone shouted, "Now what?"
I looked down at Mitch. He nodded and walked up the steps. I looked out over the crowd and said, "We'll let Judge Williams decide his fate." All eyes were on Mitch as he made it to the top of the platform. He looked out across the crowd, then at Micah, who wouldn't make eye contact. I think he was starting to get the idea he wasn't getting out of this. Mitch turned to face the crowd and licked his lips.
"These men have committed grave crimes against the community. Murder, maiming, and sowing distrust."
Mitch turned to face Micah.
"You've admitted your crimes, and on behalf of our community, I sentence you to death by hanging.
Shock filled Micah's face as he started to cry out.
You said if I told the truth, you wouldn't kill me.
The crowd erupted with shouts of, hang him, hang them all. Micah, still trying to talk his way out of this, struggled. But he was no match for Dalton, who roughly pushed him into position on the platform and pulled the rope over his head. Micah tucked his chin into his chest in a last-ditch effort to keep the rope from tightening around his neck. But Dalton gave him an open palm slap to the groin. It let the air out of Micah, and Dalton was easily able to cinch the noose tight. Sarge came up on the platform as this was being done. The two Cubans began to understand just what was happening, and one of them, the less injured of the two, began to pray in Spanish.
As the highest-ranking military official here, I sentence these two soldiers to death for war crimes committed against civilians. They'll share the same sentence as Micah, hanging by the neck until they are dead.
All the while, Micah was still blubbering, sobbing, and cursing us for lying to him. He'd spent his days since the day aligning himself with those he felt were stronger. He was happy to do whatever he was told, with no thought or consideration for those he was helping to harm, so long as it meant he could eat and live comfortably. But that time was about to run out, at the end of a rope. Mike and Ted moved the Cubans over their trap doors and placed the nooses around their necks without protest. They were resigned to their fate. Or maybe they decided they would go out like men and not like a coward. I couldn't imagine what was going through their minds. I know I wouldn't stand patiently by while someone hanged me. They'd surely get the job done, but by God, I'd make it a challenge for them. Once the men were in position, we stepped back from them. I looked down to see Danny holding the rope from Micah's trap door. He had it wrapped around his wrist and was staring intently at the man. Thad had the other two ropes, one wrapped around each wrist as well. Danny sneered at Micah and said,
"May you rot in hell!"
And he gave the rope a violent jerk. The trapdoor fell out from under Micah's feet, and the rope caught him. But it didn't break his neck. Instead, he writhed against his own weight, slowly suffocating him. Danny stepped towards him, Micah's upturned face only a foot or so higher than his own, as the two Cubans fell through the platform, snapping their ropes tight. Danny watched with morbid intensity as Micah kicked and jerked, as the blood vessels in his eyes burst. When the man finally stopped moving, Danny studied him for a moment longer. Then he drew his pistol and shot Micah in the face. There would be no doubt about whether he was dead or not. The crowd was silent. The bloodlust leading up to the act drained away as they watched life leave the three men. Their limp bodies turning slowly from their ropes. The crowd started to drift out of the park, the spectacle of dying men and the rush of morbid excitement that comes with it, now spent. Leaving those that witnessed it feeling an uncertain shame in the pit of their stomachs. We walked down off the platform where Cecil was waiting. He nodded approvingly as we passed him.
"It was done good, done right," he said. "It's never good, Cecil," Sarge replied.
Cecil looked at the three men as they twisted slowly.
"Maybe not good, but some men just need killing. Micah is a sneaky little shit willing to sell his soul to the highest bidder. He was a constant source of distrust and trouble. I bet things calm down a little around here now."
He nodded at one of the Cubans.
"As for those two poor bastards, war sucks. It's the price you pay to play that game.
I've seen worse done to men who were captured. But we aren't like that. We're not going to torture them just for the sake of inflicting pain. To extract information? Sarge asked. Sure. Anyone who says torture doesn't work during interrogations has never properly employed it. But that's the end of its usefulness. Beyond that, it's just bloodlust. And that's where we have to draw the line, lest we become like them. Cecil nodded. It's a dangerous line, that's for sure. It needed to be done, and it's done, I replied.
It seems to have calmed people down, Ted said, as he watched the crowd slowly plod away from the park. Looks like all their piss and vinegar is spent.
When pressure builds, you have two choices, Sarge said. You either vent it, or you don't, and it explodes. He jabbed a thumb over his shoulder towards the men on the ropes. This was the vent.
That's a fucked up way of looking at it, I said.
Why? You saw these people when we got here. Only thing missing was the pitchforks and torches. Now they're calmed down. They got their blood.
I hate to think we hung those men just to satisfy some group bloodlust, I replied.
We didn't.
Danny's voice caught me off guard. We hung them because they killed Bobby. And many others. You saw the bodies. You saw what they did. They needed killing. And we killed them. Period. I nodded.
You're right, my friend. They deserved it for Bobby.
The bodies were cut down and loaded into the bed of the little red truck. We took them over to the police department. I wanted to see the other man, the one Shane killed. I asked Eric to ride over with us to verify it was him, since he knew the man best. We parked in front of the roll-up door and Sean came out. He looked over the side of the bed and nodded.
It's done.
Where's the other one? I asked. Then I noticed his face. Both of his eyes were blackened and his nose looked broken.
Damn, dude. You look like you were hit by a truck.
He jerked his head towards the roll-up door.
The truck's in there. Hang on. I'll open it.
And he went inside the building. We waited out front as the metal door clanged and banged as it rolled up. As the door rose, the feet of a man came into view. I watched as the view slowly crept up his body until the man was revealed. The man's shirt was stained with blood, and flies buzzed about his open mouth and hazy eyes. Shane was standing beside him. He, too, had a black eye, and was holding his left arm close to his chest. I jutted my chin at him.
You all right?
He kicked the form on the ground.
This fucker broke a rib, I think.
You seen the docs yet? He nodded.
Yeah, we've both been to the clinic. Nothing time won't fix.
Eric stepped into the dim bay and looked down at the body. He knelt down and grabbed the man's chin and turned his face up. Looking up, he said, "This is him.
His name's Niigata. He was their torturer. Of course they called him an interrogator, but he was a sadistic bastard."
Sean snorted.
"He's not going to torture anyone else."
"How'd it go down?" I asked.
"We were following him. He went behind the old Ace Hardware. When we walked around the corner, he jumped us. Some bitch was quick and hit like a damn mule," Shane said.
"He was enjoying it. He smiled the entire time," Sean said. "It was no contest trying to fight him. He hit me in the face, then went after Shane.
I drew my pistol and shot him in the back. He actually turned around to look at me, started walking towards me. So I kept shooting him until he fell."
"And this one?" Eric asked, pointing to a bullet hole over the man's left eye.
"Insurance," Shane grunted. "I didn't want the bastard getting back up."
"It was worth it," I said. "The old man knows where they're operating out of now." The Russians and Cubans have teamed up with the remnants of the DHS. They're holed up in the auto auction off the 429. He's working with the DOD guys up at Eglin to deal with them.
What do you want us to do with him? Shane asked. I pointed at the truck. If you don't mind, I'll leave these three here for the night. Tomorrow, take them to the farm and bury them there. Let them fertilize the field.
Will do. I'll get with Cecil. He'll have a hole dug for them.
We unloaded the bodies from the truck into the bay. It was surreal seeing so many bodies piled up as they were.
But it was the reality. Dead bodies didn't faze me any more than seeing roadkill to possum now.
It was just another part of the fabric of life. We shook hands and said we'd get with them later, before Eric and I loaded into the truck and drove back to the park. We found everyone gathered around Sarge's Hummer. Cecil and the old man were talking when we walked up.
Was it him? Sarge asked.
I nodded.
Yeah, it was him.
One less vermin to worry about.
Sarge nodded.
Good. I'll get with the general and we'll put together a plan to hit those pricks at the auto auction.
Mike clapped his hands.
Mean I'm going to get to blow some shit up with that big-ass gun? Goody, goody, goody.
Stop acting like a damn snot-nosed runt for crying out loud. Act your age for a change.
He is, Ted quickly replied. He is acting his age. He stopped aging at 13.
The old man snorted.
Explains why your nuts ain't dropped yet.
He said it quickly and without thought. Then he looked at Mel and said,
Sorry, Mel.
Mel didn't miss a beat.
It's all right, she replied.
Then she looked at Mike and said, Don't worry. They'll come down on their own. Mike blushed and adjusted his crotch, mumbling.
He did a long time ago.
Mel patted his shoulder, saying, Sure they have. And she walked towards the little red truck. Naturally, this got a big laugh out of the old man and Ted. It made me smile, too. Mike looked at me, and I shrugged.
How's that field of corn coming, Cecil? I asked.
About ready. I checked a couple of ears earlier today. They're drying out nicely.
You got security on that field?
Sarge asked.
Cecil nodded with a laugh.
You're damn right. You think you could plant acres of corn and expect it to be there when you come back? Not hardly. We've run a few people off.
Mitch sentenced a couple we caught in there poaching corn to labor at the farm. But for the most part, it's all there.
That's going to make a shit ton of cornmeal, I said. How's the mill coming along?
We got it working. Have to run a generator, but it'll turn out some corn. We even found a burl corn sheller at Reniger's and got it working.
We'll be able to shell the corn out a lot faster, Cecil replied.
We'll be up to our eyeballs in grits and cornbread, Sarge said.
Cecil smiled and patted his belly.
I ain't going to complain none. Cornbread will go nice with the beans we got in those supplies.
Cecil, we're going to be having a wedding out at the ranch here shortly. You should come out, I said. He smiled a broad, toothy smile.
Who's getting married?
I put a hand on Thad and Eric's shoulders.
These two are.
The smile vanished and Cecil's face turned sour.
Not to each other, I hope.
The surprise on Thad's face was instant and Eric muttered,
What? Fuck, what?
I cocked my head to the side and gave each of them a quick glance. Now, Cecil, I thought they made a fine couple.
What?
Eric shouted. Apparently, it was the only thing he could manage. Thad started to laugh, slapping his knee.
You a mess, Morgan.
Cecil broke out into a broad smile again and started to laugh. Mike was standing behind Thad, and, in as deep a voice as he could muster, which wasn't much, he said,
You want to be the husband, or you want to be the wife?
Thad was still laughing, but Eric was slightly shocked.
I want to be the husband, he shouted.
Mike started to laugh and slapped Thad on the back and shouted, "Then get over here and suck your wife's dick."
The joke made Thad laugh even harder. Sarge got a chuckle out of it as well, but he shook his head at the same time.
"You just don't know how to be a grown-up, do you?"
With a blank stare, Mike replied,
"No, I'm a Toys R Us kid."
"No, you are, without a doubt, the poster child for infanticide," Sarge snorted back.
Cecil cleared his throat and stepped towards Thad.
"Thad, I'm happy for you."
He stuck his hand out and shook Thad's. Cecil then turned to Eric.
"You too, my friend. This is good news. Seeing that people can still fall in love in all this."
He smiled again. "Maybe we'll get some youngin' soon." Eric looked down at his feet and hesitantly replied,
"Well, Fred's pregnant."
Cecil broke out into a loud, raucous laugh.
"That's great news! When's this wedding going to take place?"
"Day after tomorrow," Thad replied.
Cecil smiled.
"I'd be honored to be there."
Chapter 10 Everyone was up early. There was still a lot to do. With the loss of Bobby so fresh, everyone was looking for something to cheer them. A little bright spot in the darkness. So, the ladies, all of them, even Jamie, were busy in the kitchen. Naturally, Bobby's absence was felt. But she was with them in spirit, as her name came up often. Danny was spending his time with the kids. He had the entire troop out at the pond fishing. He was hurting, but so were they. Jason, Edie, already lost their parents. Now, they've lost Bobby. Danny had always wanted to have kids, but Bobby was reluctant. When the kids lost their parents, he seized on the opportunity. He was good with kids, having helped raise all three of my girls, and they loved him. So, I assumed it was a coping mechanism for him to spend so much time with the kids. And it was the best method for him, too. He knew there was still someone depending on him. He couldn't just sink into a pit of despair and not look up. He had to take care of them. And they were the anchor holding him in place. Not to mention, he had a large and very concerned group around. But we didn't hover over Danny. He was given his space. He needed to grieve, and we allowed him the time and room to do so. But everyone made sure he knew we were thinking about him. I was sitting on the back porch watching the kids be frustrated by the little bait stealers in the pond. They were keeping him busy baiting hooks, except Little Bit. She would pinch her own bread balls onto the hook. Miss Kay gave them a heel of bread that Danny dampened with a little water to make it sticky so it would stay on the hooks. Doc strolled past me, his medic pack over his shoulder, and pushed the screen door open and went down towards the pond. He was constantly checking Danny's hand, changing the dressings, and inspecting the sutures that closed the large wound. He was diligent in ensuring infection didn't set in. Seeing Doc approach, Danny took a seat in one of the plastic chairs, ready for his exam. Doc dropped his pack and pulled another chair over.
"How's the hand feeling?" Doc asked.
"No better, no worse." Edie missed another fish, and with her bait gone, she was excitedly asking for another bread ball. Danny told her she'd have to wait for a minute.
"You gotta wait, sweetie. Doc here wants to poke and prod me first."
She cocked her head to the side and scrunched her nose.
"Is he taking the band-aid off?"
Danny nodded and she leaned her pole against a young cypress tree.
"I want to see it."
Little Bid and Jace quickly joined her. They all stood watching as Doc unwrapped the gauze and removed the sponges that absorbed the drainage from the wound. Edie moved closer and looked over Doc's knee.
Where's your fingers?
Danny turned the hand over. They're gone.
But where'd they go?
The bomb took them, Little Bit said, as she watched Doc work.
Can you get them back?
Jace asked.
No, they're not coming back,
Danny said with a hint of sadness in his voice.
That's true, but Mr. Danny will be all right, Doc said as he cleaned the wound. He'll be back up to speed in no time. He just won't be able to give you a high five.
Doc leaned in close to Edie and added in a silly tone,
It'll have to be a high three.
The kids all laughed. Even Danny half chuckled at the comment. Doc smiled and rubbed Edie's hair.
It's okay, Edie said,
as she took Danny's other hand with both of hers.
He still has this one.
She pulled the hand up to her face and rubbed it on her cheek. Doc smiled and looked at Danny and the little girl.
Like I said, Mr. Danny will be just fine.
As I watched this, Mel walked up and leaned against me. I looked up at her. Her arms were crossed over her chest, and she was looking down at me.
What?
I asked. Have you got those flowers yet? I rolled my eyes. I'd been selected to fill buckets with the bright pink azalea flowers that grew in huge numbers at our old house. No, not yet. Mel leaned down and whispered in my ear.
Don't you think you should get that done? You know the wedding is tomorrow, right?
I rocked my head side to side.
Yeah, I'm going, I replied, as I got to my feet.
Remember, it's a secret, Mel added.
I waved over my shoulder at her as I headed for the screen door.
I know.
Walking out to the shed, I grabbed a couple of empty 5-gallon buckets and headed for the gate. It was nice out, for a summer day, and I was going to walk down to the old house. As I got closer to the bunker, I saw the National Guardsmen standing their watch. These guys were very diligent and never complained about having to be on duty. It said something about what it must be like in town at the armory. Walner stepped out from under the tarp. I smiled at the sight. He was starting to get comfortable out here. Gone was the body armor and the heavy BDU blast top. He was in a t-shirt and boonie hat and even had the legs of his pants rolled up to his knees. A rather funny sight with the boots he was wearing.
You guys look like you're getting into the groove, I said.
He looked down at himself and smiled. Someone once told me, conditions are what you make them. I laughed. Indeed, my friend. He turned to the north and pointed to a small house that sat off the road in a 5-acre field of grass. A scattering of oak trees grew in front of it.
What's Thad doing over there?
Looking at the house, I replied, I do believe he's getting the place ready for his soon-to-be bride.
I thought that was it. It's a nice little place. It's just separated from everyone else.
I nodded.
Yeah.
But I think Thad is looking for a little separation. Somewhere he can begin to rebuild his life.
He's been hard at it. We've offered to help several times, but he always turns us down.
I reached out and gripped Walner's shoulder.
That's because you guys do enough for us. I'll go over and check on him.
We're happy to be here. Anything you guys need, just ask. With a smile and nod, I replied, I know, my friend. I looked over at the house Thad was preparing for himself and Mary. He appeared in the door as I crossed the yard. He was working a broom, and a cloud of dust erupted from the open door.
You'll make someone a fine wife one of these days with domestic skills like that, I said.
Thad looked up and smiled.
You think she'll like this?
I nodded and poked my head in the door.
I think so. We need to get a couple things going over here for you guys, but I think she'll be happy.
We walked through the house, that had once been owned by an old man. He lived there alone and kept to himself. I had never even spoken to him, but he disappeared shortly after the event, and I never saw him again. The house was in pretty good shape, though it was obvious it had been gone through many times. I know our group had raided it on several occasions, but unlike others, we didn't trash the places we looked through. The little house had lots of windows, and it was bright inside, and surprisingly cool. Thad had the rear sliding glass door open, revealing the small pool out back. It was nearly full of water, but was green now, of course.
"I'm going to build another water tower here and fill it from the pool," Thad said. "It'll allow us to flush the toilets, at least. I'm sure we can sort something out. I wish we had more solar panels to get you some power," I replied.
"We can live without the power, but having a flushing toilet is really nice."
I nodded, and Thad said,
"I need a favor, Morgan."
I looked at him and replied,
"Anything, buddy."
He rubbed his hand through his hair.
"I really need a haircut before the wedding."
I agreed.
"Yeah, you do,"
and laughed. "But I only know how to do one kind." He smiled again.
"I know. That's the kind I want.
Let me take care of a little project real quick, and then we'll get to that haircut." Thad looked around the house and nodded.
"I have a little more to do here, and I'll meet you at your place."
"Sounds good to me," I replied, as I headed for the door and grabbed my bucket. As I continued towards the old place, I saw Mike coming from the direction of his house. He waved me down, and I stopped and waited for him.
"Hey, Morg," he greeted me.
"What's up, Mikey?"
"Hard dicks and helicopters."
"Not anymore," I replied with a laugh.
"Oh, sorry to hear that, man. You know, you used to be able to get a pill for that. Gonna be kind of tough now, though."
I shook my head. "I meant the helicopters, asshole."
He looked around and stretched.
"I know."
"What do you want?" I asked, trying to get to the point.
"Oh, yeah, hey, I need some ice."
"For what?"
He cocked his head to the side.
"Oh, I didn't tell you?"
I waved him off.
"Yeah, yeah, how much?"
"A few big blocks would be nice."
"I can put some into the freezer in a little while. When do you need them?"
"Tomorrow."
I knew he was up to something, and that was always worrying when it came to Mike.
"You weren't going to do anything stupid at the wedding, are you?"
He looked shocked.
"I am an asshole, but even I ain't that big of an asshole."
"No, this is just my little gift. You'll like it, I promise."
"Okay, it'll be ready in the morning."
He clapped his hands together.
"Perfect."
He hopped backwards and pointed at me.
"You're the man, Morgan."
Then he spun around and trotted back towards his house. I shook my head, smiling as I headed down the road. Finally making it to the house, I started to pluck the bright pink flowers from the azalea bushes. Once the bucket was full, I headed towards home. When I came out onto the road, Meathead and Drake came trotting up. They were panting heavily and whining. I stopped and patted Meathead.
"What's wrong, buddy?"
I looked down the road and asked,
"Where's your sister?"
Drake looked down the road, then back at me. He trotted down the road towards the highway, then stopped and looked back at me. Meathead licked my hand and whined again. I stood up and started towards Drake. Meathead took off at a run towards Drake. The two dogs waited as I walked towards them, then ran off as I got closer. I'm not one to think dogs are of superior intellect, but you certainly build a relationship with the animals over the years. You get to where you can read them, and they can read you. And it was obvious they were trying to tell me something. And the fact little sister wasn't with them was very worrying. I thought she could be hurt. For an instant, the image of her being hit by a car flashed into my mind, but I dismissed it just as quickly. There'd have to be cars in the road for that to happen. The dogs turned north, running up the center of the road. They were moving way faster than I was, but they would stop and wait for me to close the distance before taking off again. They turned west and headed into the woods. Bad memories rushed back to me of Reggie's niece. We were headed towards Baptist Lake. I tried to avoid further memories of Reggie by thinking of the dogs. I always wondered where they went when they ran off, and they obviously roamed further than I imagined. They continued to lead me into the woods. They seemed very anxious, almost desperate for me to follow them. I was getting a little annoyed. We were far from home, and no one knew I'd left. No one knew where I was. As that thought began to form in my mind, I started to hear voices. The dogs' attitudes changed as well. They slowed down and began moving stealthily through the woods. It was then I realized I didn't have my rifle. All I had was my pistol. Shit, I muttered to myself as I pulled the .45. It was pure instinct when the weapon came from its holster that my fingers would run over the chamber and striker indicators. Both were positive. The pistol was ready to go. The smell of wood smoke started to drift through the air. Then, the smell of cooking meat. My stomach started to churn as a fear crept up in me, the sudden realization of where the dogs were taking me and what I was about to see. The dogs stopped and looked back at me. I slowly moved up to them, pausing to rub Drake's ears. I picked my steps carefully as I closed the distance between myself and what I now knew was two men. Moving closer, they came into view. The two men were sitting on a log, their backs to me, with a fire burning in front of them. A large piece of meat was on a spit over the fire. They looked like all the scavengers I had seen since the event. Unlike people in town, who tried to keep some semblance of appearance, the people who wandered the woods were always ratty-looking. Both had long, wild hair and beards to match. Their clothes had a sheen of grime to them, and experience told me they'd smell like hot garbage. I looked around their camp and saw a skinned carcass hanging from a tree. Below it was a pile of offal and white fur. I nearly puked, and my head began to spin as the realization of that terrible thought I'd had while walking in set in. They were cooking my dog. Restraining myself for a moment, I looked the camp over. There was a .22 rifle leaned against the tree that the carcass swung from. I didn't see any other guns. I slipped the ASP from my vest and gripped it tight. I was about 30 feet from the men, a long distance to close. I wanted to just shoot them, and yet I didn't. I started to close the distance to them as fast as I could while trying to be quiet. But it wasn't enough. About 10 feet from them, they both turned to look over their shoulders. Both men immediately jumped to their feet. One was holding a large knife, like a big kitchen knife. The other looked at the rifle. I dropped the ASP and raised the pistol in a two-handed grip. "Don't even fucking think about it," I shouted. The one with the knife grabbed it tight. I could see in his eyes he was ready to fight. "You toss that blade into the woods before I kill you," I said as calmly as I could. The other two dogs came running into the camp. I heard them come past me and saw when the two men noticed them as well. I could see the recognition in their eyes. The one man still had the knife, and I told him again to throw it into the woods. His friend looked at him, and as yet, neither man had said a word. The one with the knife nodded at me. "You the sheriff?" I nodded, and he took another look at the knife before tossing it into the woods. I motioned with the pistol. "Sit down in that log." The two men shared a glance, then reluctantly sat down. The dogs were sniffing around the hide of their friend piled on the ground. One of the men
with a thick shock of red hair and beard to match, asked,
"Them your dogs?"
He spoke with a thick drawl that reminded me of Appalachia. I'd walked around in front of them, keeping their fire between us.
"Yes, they are."
"Shit," he muttered and shook his head.
"It's just a dog,"
his partner practically spat.
"No, it's not. It's my dog, and my little girl is going to be very sad you fuckers killed her."
"We gotta eat, too. You shouldn't let your dogs run around like that. You're lucky we didn't kill the other ones."
"Lucky? I'm lucky you didn't kill my other dogs?" I asked.
He shrugged and spat into the fire.
"It ain't a crime to kill a dog."
His red-headed partner glanced up at him, but didn't say anything, and turned his gaze back to the fire.
"I guess that depends on who you ask. Didn't see the collar on the dogs?" The man shrugged.
"That don't mean shit."
I wasn't sure what to do. Yes, they killed my dog, but they were obviously starving as well. Would it be right to kill a man that simply needed to eat? These thoughts were roiling in my head when the man reached out to what I now knew was a hind quarter from my dog roasting over the fire. He ripped a piece from it and stuck it in his mouth, then looked up, glaring at me as he chewed. It wasn't a conscious decision to pull the trigger, and I jumped when the Springfield barked fire. He fell backwards, landing on the ground with his mouth open and his tongue pushing the half-chewed meat around. The bullet hit him high in his chest, nearly dead center. From the sound of it, the round hit his trachea. He was gurgling and clutching his neck. His partner rolled to the side, curling into a ball on the ground. I looked down at the pistol in my hand, then back at the stricken man. He was still struggling as blood pooled in his mouth, and he coughed it out onto his chin. It mixed with the chewed meat, making for a disturbing scene. Then he looked at me and reached a hand out towards me. I shook my head and said,
"You shouldn't have killed my dog, and you damn sure shouldn't have started eating her in front of me."
I raised the Springfield, the front sight between his wide, wild eyes, and this time, I consciously pulled the trigger. The bullet struck him in the corner of his left eye. His head fell back, and blood bubbled in his mouth with his final exhale. The redhead, hearing the release of his friend's final breath, rolled over and looked at him, then at me.
"Look, I'm really sorry. We were hungry. I didn't want to kill your dog, I really didn't. But what else are we supposed to do?"
He pointed a trembling finger at me.
And you're the sheriff. You can't just kill me."
I looked down at the star pinned to my chest. I plucked it off and stuck it in my pocket. "Right now, I'm not the sheriff. To you, it's just a dog. But she was more than that to my family, and you took her from us."
"But it's just a fucking dog."
"Not to me," I replied, as I raised the pistol and fired two quick rounds into his head. I sat down on the log beside the dead man. The leg was still roasting over the fire, and I kicked it off. Holstering the pistol, I looked around. Drake and Meathead were gone. They never did like gunfire. I imagined they were probably already back at the house. Standing up, I walked over to examine little sister's hanging carcass. I shook my head and looked down at the .22. I snatched it up and gripped the barrel like a bat and smashed the rifle against the tree. The stock splintered into pieces. I looked at the barrel and action and swung it two more times until the barrel was bent nearly 90 degrees before throwing it to the ground. Going back to the two men, I found a grubby backpack and dumped it out onto the ground. An old blanket was in the pile of filthy clothes and other crap. I took the blanket over to where the dog hung and laid it out on the ground.
I piled her entrails, hide and head, into the blanket. It was then I saw she'd been shot between the eyes, at what was obviously point-blank range. I could see the powder burn in her fur. The scene was clear. The dogs, being friendly, probably came up to these guys. When they saw the rifle, I imagined Drake and Meathead ran. But Little Sister was always more tolerant of guns and wouldn't have been scared. And the bastard pointed it at her head and shot her. I looked back at the two dead men and suddenly didn't feel as conflicted as I had. I cut down the rest of her carcass, dropping it onto the blanket. Then I picked up the quarter the bastards were cooking and placed it into the blanket before folding the corners up. I picked her up and slung her over my shoulder and started back towards the road, pausing to kick the fire out. It was a long walk home with the weight of the dog over my shoulder. The longer I walked, the worse I felt about it. Sure, I always said the dogs were lazy and useless, but they were part of my family. A part I would now have to tell the rest of my family was gone. This hurt more than anything. Little Bit and the kids often played with the dogs. On really hot days, the dogs would go to Danny's and get into the pond to cool off. The kids would often be there with them as they splashed around. Her loss would certainly be missed by everyone. As I came to our road, Sarge's Hummer skidded to a stop. Ted was in the turret with a saw. Sarge was behind the wheel and looked as though he was ready to kill me.
"Where the fucking hell have you been?" he screamed as he climbed out of the truck.
I swung the blanket over my shoulder and laid it on the ground. "Getting my dog back." Sarge looked at the blanket, then at me.
"Come again?"
The other two dogs came home, and obviously upset, they led me back to where two assholes were cooking her, I said, pointing at the blanket. He looked at the blanket again, then back at me.
"Shit, Morgan, I'm sorry."
He looked down, shaking his head, and asked,
"Where are they?"
"Out in the woods," I replied, as I reached down and picked up the blanket again. "Buzzards got to eat, too."
"They shouldn't have shot your dog," Sarge replied.
"That's what I said." The old man opened the rear door of the truck.
"Lay her in here, and I'll take you home."
In the truck, Sarge looked over at me.
"Don't ever do that shit again, Morgan. We've got plenty of people and enough firepower to take care of any problems we encounter like this. But you wandering off into the woods alone..."
He looked around the truck.
"And without a damn rifle, will not happen again."
I nodded. "Yeah, I realized that once I saw them. I was just following the dogs to start with. I thought maybe she was hurt, snake bit or something. But when I saw her hanging there like that, I lost it." We were coming up on my bucket of flowers that still sat in the road. I pointed at it and said, "Stop here and let me get that." Sarge rolled to a stop, and I opened my door, leaned out, and grabbed the bucket.
"What the hell is that for?" Sarge asked.
I shrugged. "Something Mel is doing for the wedding." He reached over and grabbed my shoulder.
"Really sorry about the pup, Morgan."
I nodded. "Thanks. I need to get her home and get her buried before anyone sees her."
"We'll help you," Ted said from the back seat.
Over my shoulder, I replied, "Thanks, Ted." We made it to the house, and I told Sarge to pull around to the back, behind the shed. There was a large oak tree back there, on the edge of the woods I wanted to put her under.
"You got shovels?"
Ted asked, as he stripped his plate carrier off. I nodded.
"Yeah, I'll be right back."
I walked back to the shed and grabbed a couple of shovels and headed back. Ted took one immediately and asked for me to point out a spot. I did, and he set to work immediately. I was surprised when I went to set my spade into the dirt by Sarge snatching it from my hands.
"We got this, Morg," he said.
It didn't take the two men long to dig a hole large enough to hold her. Ted stepped out of the hole, and Sarge asked, "You going to leave her in the blanket?" As I picked it up, I replied, "Yeah. She's whole in here, and I don't want to see her again." The old man patted my back, saying, "Good call." I laid her in the hole, and they began shoveling the dirt back in. It didn't take long before the spot was nothing more than a place of disturbed earth. I studied it for a minute before remarking, "You know, I'm getting kind of tired of digging these holes." Sarge took a noisy, deep breath and blew it out. "I know what you mean, but we'll all end up in one." He looked up at me and said, "None of us gets out of this alive." I nodded and looked back at the house. "I need to go in and tell Mel what happened." I thought for a minute and added, "But I think I'm going to lie to the girls."
"I was hoping you would," Sarge replied. "They don't need to know what happened."
"Especially little bit," Ted added. "Agreed," I said with a nod.
"We'll leave it to you then, Morg. Holler if you need anything," Sarge said.
As I turned to walk to the house, he grabbed my arm and said, "Don't ever do any dumb shit like that again, or we'll be digging your hole, and I don't want to do that." When I got into the house, I couldn't bring myself to tell Mel what happened. When she saw me, she asked, "Did you get them?" Fred was in Mel's wedding dress, standing on a chair so Mel could pin it up to make some alterations.
"Sure did, bucket full."
Fred had her arms up in the air, holding the position Mel needed.
"Bucket of what?"
Mel stuck a pin in her teeth and replied,
"Don't you worry about it."
"Where are the girls?" I asked. "They're over at Bobby's," Mel replied without thinking. I saw her flinch when she said it, but she carried on. "I'll go check on them in a little bit." But before I left, I filled several large plastic containers with water and put them in the freezer.
"What's that for?"
Mel asked, as she pinned another piece of the dress back.
"No idea. Mikey needs it."
Once the water was in the freezer, I left the house. Meathead and Drake were lying on the front porch. They weren't panting now, but they looked listless and unenthused. I sat down on the bench, and both their tails thumped the porch. Rubbing Meathead's ears, I said,
"I'm sorry, old buddy. I did my best, but she's home now."
As I spoke, his tail thumped a little faster. There was no way in hell he understood what I was saying, but I suppose in some way he knew that I was talking about his little sister. I left them lounging in the porch and headed for Danny's. The kids were out back playing. It looked like bows and arrows were back in. Palmetto stem arrows flew back and forth across the yard. I smiled at them as I climbed up onto the porch. Perez was sitting in a rocker, watching them. A pile of trim palmetto fronds were at his feet.
"You the official arrow maker?" I asked.
He looked down at his feet and replied,
"Someone needs to keep him in ammo."
I looked out at the yard. It was cluttered with arrows and squealing and wheeling kids. It made me smile. Fortunately, they weren't shooting at one another. They were shooting at several palmetto fronds stuck in the ground. I patted Perez on the shoulder and said, "Don't let them kill one another." "It's under control," he replied, as I walked into the house. The house was busy. Mary was in her dress, just as Fred was next door. Jess was trying to follow Kay's instructions on how to pin the dress for modification. All the while, Kate was busy on a cake. Jamie was helping Jess pin the dress up. I looked around and asked, "Where's Danny?"
"He's out back behind the pond," Kate replied, without looking up from her mixing bowl.
I didn't reply and quickly left the way I came in. Nothing good was going to come from me being in there. I walked out to the pond and could see Danny on the back side of it, swinging a weed eater. I shook my head because he shouldn't have been doing that. I walked out and he shut the machine down when he saw me. "What the hell are you doing?" I asked. He looked around, as though the answer to my question were obvious.